Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we're diving into a topic that personally fascinates me, the inseparable bond between knight and warhorse.
And when I say inseparable, I truly mean it. This wasn't the kind of rider-horse combination we know today. This was a combat unit that had grown together over years.
What impresses me most about this, these horses were essentially prey animals, and yet they learned to gallop right into the thick of battle.
That's the heart of the matter. Imagine having to teach an animal whose natural instinct says, run away when danger strikes, to do exactly the opposite. We're talking about several years of intensive training. Estimates range from 2 to 4 years, and that began when the horse itself was only 3 or 4 years old.
Several years? That's almost as long as some vocational training programs today.
And correspondingly expensive. A true warhorse, a destrier, which was the crème de la crème, cost a small fortune, probably many times what a common farmer earned in a year.
That also explains why not every knight automatically had such a horse. There were different types. The destrier was essentially the premier model for tournaments and major battles. Then there was the courser, faster and more agile, for quick skirmishes and longer campaigns.
Yes, and that one was actually more popular in combat. Not quite as massive, but more enduring.
And then the Roundsea, as a general-purpose horse, for squires or poorer knights who couldn't afford a destrier.
But regardless of type, the training was brutally demanding. These horses didn't just learn to gallop straight ahead. They had to be able to move sideways, backwards, make lightning-fast turns. Also, the knight could always stay facing his opponent.
That was the tactical advantage of being mounted. You're sitting up there, you have reach, you have an overview, but only if your horse cooperates. A foot soldier could move around you, and if your horse doesn't respond,
then you're done for, exactly. The knight had to handle shield and lance, so he couldn't be working the reins with both hands as well.
So the horse had to respond to minimal signals. Weight shifts, leg pressure.
The finest coordination. And here's what's interesting. These fundamentals, so how should I put it, this lateral work, shoulder in and such, you find the basics of that in later classical horsemanship.
I've wondered about that too. Is there really a direct connection?
For the basic maneuvers, yes. They develop continuously over time. However, and this is where you have to be careful, the spectacular jumps, the levade and capriole that you see today at the Spanish riding school, those came later. Renaissance, Baroque. Medieval training was more pragmatic, more effective, less showy.
Makes sense. In real combat, you don't need elegant figures. You need a horse that doesn't lose its mind when someone's swinging a sword right next to it.
That was exactly the point. Getting them used to the sounds of battle, to weapon movements, to, well, chaos. The training involved gradual exposure. First quiet sounds, then louder, first gentle touches with the lance, then actual combat simulation.
And the different horses?
Right, they had very different strengths. The destrier was perhaps 140 to 160 centimeters tall, so not as huge as you might think, but incredibly muscular. Short back, strong bones, powerful hindquarters for explosive maneuvers.
That's fascinating. So not draft horse giants like people often imagine?
No, more like, think of a compact athlete. Power and agility combined. The courser was then leaner, more elegant, perfect for longer campaigns where endurance mattered more than pure striking power.
So a knight ideally had several horses with him?
If he could afford it, absolutely. The destrier for the major battle, a courser for skirmishes along the way, roundsies for everyday use, and sumpters as pack horses. That was a whole stable on legs.
And for that you needed staff, feed, care. No wonder knights were so expensive to maintain.
The horse was often worth more than the armor, and that's saying something.
What I'm still curious about, these movements on the battlefield. How should we picture this? The knight gives a signal and the horse...
And the horse reacts instantly. Say a foot soldier tries to sneak up from the side. The knight shifts his weight, minimal leg pressure, and the horse turns in a split second. The knight stays facing his opponent, shield protects him, lance can strike.
And he uses the height advantage. Striking downward always gives you the upper hand.
The reach. With a lance from horseback, you have an enormous radius. Foot soldiers had to get close to you first, and the horse could back away, dodge, reposition.
Forward into the attack, sideways to evade, backwards to create distance.
Exactly, and always keeping the enemy in sight. That was the art of it. These horses were trained to recognize threats and adjust position to seize opportunities.
Almost like a dance. A deadly dance.
And one that only worked when knight and horse were truly a unit. Not just technically, emotionally too. But we'll get to that.
And this is where it gets really exciting. Weapons training on horseback. Because the movements alone are useless if the knight can't actually fight.
And that was an art in itself. Controlling the horse is one thing, but simultaneously handling a 3 to 4 meter long lance...
Absolutely. That requires a completely different technique than on foot. The famous couched lance technique, where the lance was tucked under the arm.
Can you explain that in more detail?
The lance was held horizontally, firmly tucked under the arm, pressed against the body. Elbow up, the lance extending forward over the horse. And then you don't use your arm strength. You use the entire mass of horse and rider for the thrust.
That's the crucial point. A foot soldier with a spear only has his own strength. A knight at full gallop? He's got several hundred kilos behind him.
And we have a fantastic historical source for this, the Bayeux Tapestry. It depicts the Battle of Hastings from 1066, Norman cavalry against Anglo-Saxon infantry. Nearly 70 meters long, showing over 200 horses and mules.
And what's interesting is, you can see the transition there. Some riders are still holding the lance overhead for throwing, others already have it tucked under their arm. The technique was in flux at that time.
The lance also wasn't designed to last forever. It often broke on impact. That's why knights carried spare lances. And after the first clash, they switched to their...
Exactly, to their secondary weapon. Sword, battle axe, whatever.
But before we get to swords, the spears. They were more versatile than lances. Shorter, lighter, primarily for thrusting. Throwing was more for light cavalry.
Close range thrusting, that was standard. Throwing more for light cavalry, and in emergencies as a backup lance. Multiple functions, one weapon.
The flexibility was enormous, especially in chaotic skirmishes, where a long lance quickly becomes a hindrance.
And the horse had to go along with all of it. The movements, the weight, the jolts from lance strikes.
As we mentioned earlier, desensitization training was absolutely crucial. The horses had to be able to withstand all of this, from the first gentle touches to complete combat chaos.
Blood, screaming people, clanging weapons right next to their ears. A normal horse would panic.
That's why the training took years. The horse had to learn to stay calm and focused, even when everything around it was falling apart. Only then could the knight concentrate on fighting, instead of on his panicking animal.
Now let's move on to swords. That's where tactics get really interesting.
Wielding a sword from horseback is...
Yes, it's strategically completely different from fighting on foot. You have the height advantage, you strike downward. But you also have to be careful not to hit your own horse.
Historical treatises describe various striking techniques. The goal was always surprise and versatility. The opponent should never know where the next blow is coming from.
A sweeping arc from one side, then suddenly a thrust from the other. Quick changes, unpredictable. Plus the shield for defense.
And then there's this one technique that absolutely fascinates me. The murder stroke. Have you looked into that?
Oh yes, the murder stroke is... How should I describe it? You grip the sword by the blade and use the pommel like a mace.
That sounds completely insane at first. Why would anyone flip their sword around?
Against plate armor. In the 14th and 15th centuries, armor became so good that normal sword strikes were practically useless. You couldn't cut through the steel, so you needed blunt force.
And the pommel is heavier than the blade tip. More mass, more impact. Aimed at the helmet or the joints, that's how you could still do damage through armor.
The technique comes from the German fencing tradition. You grab the sword with both hands on the blade, essentially flip it around, and then...
And then you swing it like a hammer. That's so clever. The sword becomes an all-purpose weapon.
From that position, you could also grapple, trip the opponent, wrench the weapon from their hand. But that all belongs to armored foot combat.
What impresses me about this, the murder stroke was really designed for armored foot combat. On horseback, you'd more likely use the lance or regular strikes.
Right. Foot combat was something else entirely. On horseback, it was more about balance and timing with lance or sword. And that's where all aspects of the training come together. The horse training, the weapon handling.
Speaking of shields, they're often underestimated. Not just for defense, right?
Absolutely not. The shield was also an offensive weapon. You could block with it, but also strike, shove, knock your opponent off balance.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
And from horseback, you again have that downward angle. A shield bash downward on a foot soldier, he goes down.
The entire arsenal, lance, spear, sword, shield, had to be switched between fluidly. The right weapon for the situation, the right technique.
And the horse in the middle of it all, going along with everything without panicking. That's the true achievement of this combat unit. Now we come to an aspect that touches me personally the most, the emotional side of this relationship.
And this isn't some romantic myth. When you consider how much time knight and horse spend together, we are talking years, not weeks, not months.
The years of training we discussed, that creates a bond. Every day together, doing exercises, maneuvers, combat simulations, a connection develops.
And don't forget the squire. He was essentially the horse's personal caretaker. The term destrier comes from the Latin dextrarius, the right one. Today, this is often interpreted to mean the squire led the warhorse as a hand horse on the right side. Though this isn't directly stated anywhere in medieval sources.
The right side? Why specifically that one?
That's at least one common explanation. The squire walked on the right, led the horse with his right hand. This possibly kept the left side, the shield side, of the knight clear. Though this isn't historically documented.
Whether historically documented or not, the logic behind it is certainly plausible.
And the squire also handled the daily care?
Feeding, grooming, checking the hooves. The warhorse was only saddled for training and combat. On marches, the knight rode a simpler horse, and the squire led the destrier alongside. The valuable animal was to be spared.
A wealthy knight often had several horses, ideally the warhorse, a riding horse, and one for the squire. Depending on wealth, this could vary. It was a whole operation.
And imagine what that means. Working with the same animal every day, caring for it, learning its moods. When it's nervous, when it's tired.
Or when it's afraid. Eventually you sense that instinctively.
And the horse learns just as much. It recognizes its rider's voice, his movements, his tension. Mutual trust develops.
This is comparable to human-animal relationships today. Riders who work with their horses today, they describe it in very similar ways.
Sources also show that knights often identified with the strength and beauty of their horses. It wasn't just a means of transport or a weapon. It was, well, almost part of their own identity.
And a status symbol, of course. A magnificent warhorse said a lot about the knight. But behind that status was genuine connection.
Historical sources speak of knights who, despite their combat abilities, also had a human, caring side. They looked after their animal companions, took care of them.
That contradicts this image of the emotionless warrior. Knights were individuals with real bonds.
In medieval epics, horses are often mentioned by name. Veillantif, for example, Roland's horse in the Song of Roland. Or Bayard, the legendary steed that could carry four brothers at once.
They had names, personalities in the stories.
Exactly. They were portrayed as individuals, not interchangeable animals. That says a lot about the appreciation.
And when you consider how valuable these horses were, economically speaking, a fortune, it makes sense that losing a warhorse also hit hard emotionally.
It wasn't just money lost. A companion was lost. One you had spent years with. In battle, in training, on endless marches.
That makes the whole thing so much more human. Behind all the combat technique and rattling weapons are real relationships.
And this bond wasn't just touching. It was vital for survival. A horse that doesn't trust its rider reacts wrongly in combat. Then both are in danger.
So it wasn't just about sentimentality. The trust had to be there for the entire combat unit to function.
The horse had to know, my rider won't put me in unnecessary danger. And the knight had to know, my horse will stay calm when it counts.
That's a mutual contract, without words, but binding.
And that's why this partnership on the battlefield is so fascinating. Two living beings working together in perfect harmony, because they know and trust each other.
Today, mounted combat is also reenacted. At tournaments, at reenactment events, the people who do this confirm it again and again.
What impresses me about that is...
Yes, that modern riders describe the same fundamental principles, the communication through minimal signals, the years of building trust.
The techniques have been refined, but the foundation remains. Human and horse as partners.
It's actually comforting, this bond between humans and animals. It's existed for centuries and works on the same principles.
Medieval knights left us something that goes beyond combat technique. An understanding of what's possible when two living beings work together.
And that greatly enriches our picture of that era. Knights weren't just armored warriors with swords and battle axes. They were people who valued and cared for their horses.
This emotional connection really provides a unique glimpse into the past. It shows the human side behind all the warfare.
And with that, we've reached the end of our journey through the world of knights and warhorses.
It's been a pleasure exploring this fascinating chapter of history with you, Carmen.
Same here. If you enjoyed this topic, at battlemerchant.com, you'll find not only an extensive range of medieval and historical products, but also many more exciting articles in the blog for anyone interested in this era.
Feel free to stop by. Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.